6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.
Good afternoon and thank you for tuning in to October 30th, 2013. And you're listening to A Public Affair with me, Tim Hansel. On today's show, we are talking about pseudoscience. In the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, why do people still believe that climate change is a hoax, or that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, or that vaccines cause autism, or that some people can speak to dead people? One might say that what these beliefs have in common is that they're based in pseudoscience, that it's fake science masquerading as real science. And joining us to talk about pseudoscience and give sort of a historical perspective on this debate is Princeton history professor Michael D. Gordon. He is the Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Princeton, and he's the director of the Fung Global Fellows Program, and also the author of The Pseudoscience Wars, Emmanuel Velikovsky and the Birth of the Modern Fringe. I get that right. So, Michael, thank you for joining us on A Public Affair.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let's just give a little bit of background about this show. The show sort of started as an idea that we were going to talk about climate change denial. That the idea was, you know, look, there's all this evidence out there, but people still sort of persist in their belief that that there is no climate change, and even if there were, it couldn't possibly be caused by humans. And just by thinking about that, we sort of broadened the perspective here, because we started seeing that this term pseudoscience being sort of thrown around, right? That pseudoscience sort of applies to, or in some circles applies to climate change denialism. But there's also these other things, right? These other things that might be sort of classified as pseudoscientific, and they are, I guess, characterized by people's sort of persistent sort of belief in something that sort of what we might call sort of normal science sort of denies. So if you looked at sort of the Wikipedia entry for pseudoscience, you see like a lot of things get sort of characterized as pseudoscientific. So there's, you know, climate change denial, but there's all these other things like acupuncture and eugenics and homeopathy, creationism, facilitated communication, ESP. All these things are sort of listed as pseudoscience. And also, at the very end of this list in Wikipedia was the revised history of the solar system proposed by Emmanuel Velikovsky. And Michael, you wrote a book on this guy. So tell us a little bit about that book.
Let me tell you, should I tell you a little bit about who Velikovsky is?
And yeah, absolutely.
Led me to this? Okay, so I've always been interested, since I started studying the history of science, and the question about how we divide science off from other kinds of knowledge. And there's a bunch of ways of doing that, right? There's science and there's non-science. And then there's this special category of pseudoscience. And I want to say two things about that. The first is that it's not just, that category doesn't just pick out bad science. There's lots of different kinds of science in the world. There's like really amazing science, there's pretty good science, there's normal, ordinary, mediocre science, there's bad science, and there's like really bad science. When people use the word pseudoscience, they don't mean to pick something out on that continuum. They mean that it's not actually science. It's something other. It looks like it and talks like it, but isn't it. It's something pseudo. So I wanted to know why people escalated to that level of controversy, taking something off the grid and putting it in this demonized category. The second thing that attracted me about the category is that no one actually thinks they're a pseudoscientist. No one has ever thought they're a pseudoscientist. Everybody who makes claims that other people call pseudoscientific, they think they're scientists or physicians or someone making a credible claim. It's not like they wake up in the morning and go to their pseudo lab and have a pseudo instrument and create fake theories that they think are fake. So from the perspective of the person so-called, they're not being pseudoscientific at all. So what we see is a debate, a struggle over who gets to label what scientific and who gets to label what as absolutely not. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in those questions, and I stumbled into the case of Emmanuel Velikovsky, who today is a name that almost no one remembers. But from 1950 until about 1980, he died in 1979, he was really a household name in a series of debates. And almost, I'm sure a large portion of your listeners who happen to be over 50 will remember this name, and I'm positive that none of your listeners under 50 have any idea who he was.
Okay.
He published a book in 1950 called Worlds in Collision, which argued that if you look through all the ancient texts of the world, legends, holy books, mythologies, you find these repeated patterns. Rain of fire from the heavens, earthquakes, flooding, dramatic goings-on in the sky, and that he believed that if you read all these as not just being separate hallucinations or separate events, but thought of them as eyewitness observations put into metaphor of a global catastrophe that's happening once everywhere, that you could explain a great deal of the catastrophic evidence of past catastrophes on the Earth's surface, as well as why all these myths say the same thing. And from that, he reverse-engineered what he thought that eyewitness testimony witnessed. What he thought happened is that a comet shot out of Jupiter, and at some point around 1500 BC hurtled towards the Earth. It got caught in electromagnetic and gravitational interaction with the Earth, tilting its axis, rupturing the crust, causing massive tidal waves. This happened around 1500 BC and is remembered as the exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt, that the plagues, all of that stuff that happens then, the emptying of the Red Sea, are not miracles, but a natural catastrophe.
Okay.
And then that comet becomes Venus. It stabilizes as the second planet from the sun, Earth's nearest planetary neighbor. So Venus is a recent planet born within the collective witness of humanity. And so that's the claim. The book is published in 1950. It rockets to the top of bestseller lists, and instantly scientists decry this thing as pseudoscience, as crack pottery, crank science, a whole series of those kinds of things.
Mm.
And that starts an active debate that goes on for an extremely long period of time. And I track all the nuances of that because we happen to have at Princeton the archives of this man's papers, his fan mail, his hate mail, etc., to try and see how someone who is believes they found a new key to Earth's history and solar system history, thinks he's making original claims, how the scientific community reacts to him, and how he reacts to that reaction up until his death in 1979. And in the 70s, he was popular on college campuses. Carl Sagan made a big point of trying to debunk him. Mm-hmm. It became this large celebrity affair, and then it vanished. And so I have a nice tight episode from which to explore some of these broader claims about what counts as science and what counts as not.
So, Michael, you have this story. You have this theory that was there, besides just kind of fitting, this theory to the mythology, did he have any other evidence in favor that Venus was a comet, or that comets can come out of Jupiter, or anything?
Absolutely. Actually, yes. Well, he claims he has evidence. The claim that comets can erupt out of planetary surfaces was an active theory discussed at the time in the astronomical literature.
Okay.
That's not weird. Coming out of Jupiter is somewhat stranger, since people seem to think it was a gas giant, which they still do, and therefore doesn't have rock of the composition of Venus.
Mm.
But he does more than just read the myths. He looks through ancient astronomical tables from Babylonia and argues that there's no records of Venus before a certain date, and then you have records of Venus after. That's how he interprets the texts. That's heavily disputed, so he argues that. And then he claims that from this evidence, he can make new predictions. He predicted, for example, that Venus should be hot, not like Mars or Mercury, planets that are cold, dead rock. Venus, he thought, was still incandescent from its rupture with Jupiter, so glowing. At the time, most people thought Venus was going to be a cold planet like Mars.
Hmm.
And then it's detected shortly after his book that it's actually quite warm. Now, the reason we think it's warm is because of a greenhouse effect on the Earth's surface caused by the cloud cover. But at the time, that seemed like a very surprising prediction. He also predicted that Jupiter would emit radio noises, which it turns out it does. He predicted that in 1953. A couple years later, it's discovered. So he claims that yes, the thing might sound outlandish, but it reconciles a series of historical puzzles and a series of empirical puzzles about catastrophic traces on the Earth's surface and makes new predictions. So he thought he was on good ground.
Mm-hmm.
The scientific community did not agree.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Michael D. Gordon. He's the Rosengarten Professor of Modern Contemporary History at Princeton, and he's talking about his book, The Pseudoscience Wars, Emanuel Velikovsky and the Birth of the Modern Fringe. And he's telling us a little bit about the history of this sort of story. So 1950? Is it 1950?
It's 1950 that the book Worlds in Collision comes
out. Okay. So this theory is sort of published that Venus was not a planet as we understand it, but rather a captured comet that erupted out of Jupiter and what, 15,000 BC?
Yeah, 1500 BC.
1500 BC.
Actually quite recently, around the time of the Exodus as he dated it with Moses.
And that would explain, in his mind, a lot of the myths that we had about sort of global catastrophes and about the parting of the Red Sea and stuff that we find in religious and sacred texts. Why? I guess the first question is how did this become so popular? I mean, it sounds to us, right, such a crazy theory. What was the nugget that sort of captured people's attention here?
Well, it's a great question. I think there's two periods of time when it captures people's attention and two nuggets. In the first period, which is 1950, when it becomes a bestseller, the two nuggets that matter are that it's incredibly well written. It's a really gripping read. And when you read it, it sounds compelling because he juxtaposes lots of bits of evidence, a quotation from here, a quotation from there, look how similar they are, look when we believe these things happened. And it comes to sound compelling when you're in the frame of the text. So for a lot of people, it seemed to, it was just a fun read, and it seemed to reconcile something about science and religion, that you could have, you could use religious texts as scientific evidence. These things that people thought were miracles aren't miracles, but instead could be the key to unlocking an episode in the history of science. The second reason why people reacted is that, got excited about the book, is that the scientific community, when I said they reacted badly, I understated it. There was several important scientists started writing to the press threatening to boycott its books. This press was Macmillan. It earned 70% of its profits from its textbook division, and a boycott would have been crippling. And so several weeks after the book comes out in early April, on June 7th, that is not long afterwards, the press transfers the hottest publishing commodity of the year to Doubleday, a competitor, which had no textbook market, which is where Velikovsky stayed until his death. So this scandal erupts in the face of massive media attention, and so it looks to certain people like a Galileo affair, that somebody has a brand new theory, and the Orthodox circle their wagons and repress the heretic. So those were the two reasons, I think, in 1950 that it got a lot of media attention, and people wanted to know what the story was about. The second wave is in the 60s, and that's when the counterculture picks up on it. And it has two things that, again, attract them to it. The first is the establishment scientists really hate this theory. And so if you are a student in a classroom and you want to goad your professor, you can bring up this guy and watch them rant. It's kind of fun. It's interesting for dorm room conversations, etc. But also, and the second part is that it seems like if it's credible, it's an alternative new science, one that unifies the sciences and the humanities, that brings ancient myth in with astronomy, both of which are very appealing to youth then and youth now. And that got people very excited. And in his 70s, he becomes a darling of this countercultural group. He headlines across campuses around the country. He is actively picked out by scientists as one of the major threats to the state of knowledge in the late 60s and early 70s. And so at different time periods, different people find something appealing about this guy.
And so, I mean, we might say, I mean, I want to go to this, you know, the scientific community reaction to this. So there's this big reaction to his theory. It's being sort of touted as sort of a paradigm of pseudoscientific study.
It It's held. You mean from the point of view of the scientist?
Yes, from the
it's held up as exemplary. One of the interesting things is that term paradigm gets popularized by Thomas Kuhn, who published his book in 1962, Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and then moves to Princeton in 1964. Velikovsky had moved to Princeton from New York City in 1952, so they're actually in the same town.
Oh, is that right?
They don't seem to interact with each other, but they're blocks apart from each other for the entire rest of Velikovsky's life.
So, so by paradigm, it meant more sort of an exemplar.
Yeah, absolutely. It's held up as everything that's wrong. it's popular among the wrong set of people. It disregards correlations between very careful evidence. It disregards evidence that's contradictory and doesn't try to account for it. And it's demagogic. It has all these qualities they don't like.
Mm-hmm. So
it's
is there
a paradigm case.
So at this point, or at any point in sort of the history of the debate over sort of pseudoscience, I mean, there's an attempt to try to sort of spell out with sort of necessary and sufficient conditions what makes something a pseudoscience and what makes something a science, right? An attempt to try to demark these sort of two things, right? This over here is real science, and this over here is pseudoscience. So what are some of those attempts? Like, what are some of the things that you say, well, here's this sort of theory, it's pseudoscientific because X. So what are some of the X's here that we might sort of try to fill in?
This is a great question. The term for this problem was coined by Cyril Karl Popper, Polish, then British philosopher of science, Polish, then, I guess, Viennese, then British philosopher of science. And he called it the demarcation problem. And his criteria is probably the most popular criterion available now. It's the one you usually find in high school textbooks today, although it wasn't in high school textbooks when I was in high school, which wasn't that long ago. And his criterion is falsifiability. That is, if a theory makes a claim and says the moon is made of green cheese, and it says you can test that by going to the moon, if the moon is not in fact made of green cheese, my theory is wrong. That theory is falsifiable. It makes a claim that says what are the conditions under which it will be proven false.
Mm-hmm.
And other theories, and for green cheese is my example. I'll use Popper's example for the other one. Psychoanalysis is his example of the bad kind,
okay,
where someone says, well, if you have these behaviors, you are a latent homosexual. And then someone says, well, what about this guy here who's actually a homosexual but doesn't have those theories? And they're like, oh, well, that guy is because of these reasons. And then you bring up a third case, and they say, well, that guy's because of these other reasons. There will never be a statement, according to Popper, where a psychoanalyst will say, if you find this instance, somebody raised in these conditions with these life experiences, and they don't have this behavior, I'm wrong. And so it's very appealing. It has a kind of daring about being willing to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There are problems with it. Big problem number one is, I'll just say the first major problem I have with it is you want any criterion like this to cut the world in the right place. You want it to include as scientific all the things we tend to think are sciences.
Mm.
And you want it to exclude as pseudoscientific all the things we tend to think are pseudosciences. And it doesn't quite do that. Because many of these fringe theories have falsifiable claims. Creationism does. It says you cannot find a transitional fossil that looks like this. And that's a falsifiable claim. Now, people have found those fossils and said, well, now you're false, and they come up with new falsifiable claims.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this can happen. The people who make these claims, again, think they're scientists, so they formulate their hypotheses in accordance with this criterion. Also, certain historical sciences, things like geology, don't lend themselves easily to making these kinds of claims. It's a very physics-based criterion.
Right.
That's one. Other criteria are you need to adhere to the consensus of the scientific community. The problem with that criterion is it doesn't let innovations like quantum mechanics or special relativity to emerge because those things radically contradicted the consensus of the scientific community. So there's a series of these criteria people have proposed. Philosophers have worked very hard to come up with these, and some of them are very ingenious. But when you push them, they don't always cut the world in the right place.
Mm-hmm. But what they try to push is, and you find you know, attempts to try to sort of define, at least, or the way that in which the term is used, seems to be something like that it's sort of fake science masquerading as real science, right?
It looks like science and pretends it's a science, but it's not. That's what the term is used for.
Okay. So what are the features? I mean, so we have, I'm going to go back to Velikovsky's sort of theory here. Is there like a falsifiability problem with Velikovsky's theory? Is there, I mean, I guess obviously it's going against the consensus of the scientific community, but what about something like Popper's falsifiability criteria?
Well, that's one of the things I find fascinating about the case. It would meet it, because he says, I think my theory requires us to redate the periodization of Egyptian history. So you should carbon date all these mummies. Carbon dating is brand new at this time period. And that will prove whether my chronology, which is derived from this new way of thinking about the world, is right. No one bothers to do the test. He also says, if I'm right, we should do these kinds of infrared spectrometry tests of Venus, and no one bothers. So he makes claims in order to do these things. He doesn't have the resources to do them himself, but the scientists don't even bother to test it because they've already decided he's pseudoscientific. When I'm critical of other people's demarcation criteria, it doesn't mean I don't think demarcation happens. It happens every day, and it's also necessary. Scientists have to decide, I'm not going to read this paper. I'm not going to do this. I only have a limited amount of time and brain in the world to do something. I'm going to focus on these questions and not these ones. And if every time someone came up with a new theory, they had to check it, we'd never get anything done. Mm. So they demarcate all the time. They usually just throw things away. They only start calling things pseudoscience when something's wrong, like when it's threatening in some way. Otherwise, they just ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And the cases you started out with, like climate change denial or autism vaccines, those are ones where there's threat. That is, this is seen as dangerous in some way, either dangerous politically or dangerous to the standards of the scientific community for what counts as plausible science. Mm. And that's when you see the pseudoscience word popping up instead of just silence, which is the usual reaction.
So usually we just sort of ignore it if it's
if
it's crazy and not worth or crazy in the minds of the scientific community. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Michael Gordon talking, and we're talking about pseudoscience. And he's a historian at Princeton who wrote this book about Emanuel Velikovsky's sort of theory about Venus, that it was a comet that had been captured, and it was kind of a sort of an out there sort of fringe theory that the scientific community called pseudoscience. And we're having a conversation about just what is pseudoscience, right? Is there a way to sort of demarcate from real science? And maybe what sorts of things would we call pseudoscience? What things do you think are pseudoscientific? And is pseudoscientific belief a threat? So that's the conversation. This is A Public Affair, and I'm your host, Tim Hansel. And let's go back to talking about pseudoscience here. So we've been talking a little bit about the demarcation problem, a little bit about what sorts of things get sort of caused or called sort of pseudoscience. Michael, you said that the falsifiability criterion doesn't sort of really work. It doesn't really pick out neatly the things that are pseudoscientific and real science. The scientific consensus criterion doesn't really work because obviously innovations in science are going to go against the scientific consensus, and sometimes things need to be overturned. So, for instance, we have to, we used to believe in phlogiston, but now we don't. So what are some other attempts, or what do you think? Is there a way to demark this or make this distinction?
So the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
The short answer is no. I don't think there's a clear way to demarcate off science from not pseudoscience in any way that's going to hold up for all cases and all times. Part of the reason for that is science isn't one thing at all at any given time or across time. There are many different kinds of sciences that explore the world with many different methods, many different topics of investigation, many different kinds of explanation. And so pseudosciences are those things that members of various sciences label as such when they contravene deeply held values of some of those sciences at any given time. But there's no reason why we should expect that we can come up with something that will rule out alchemy, phrenology, ESP, Velikovsky, and climate change denial as all the same thing. Those are all things that were called pseudosciences, but at different times, and were labeled as such for different reasons. On the other hand, I think, yes, we can do it. And the reason I know we can do it is scientists do it every single day. So every day they make decisions about what's worth following and what's not, and sometimes they pick out certain things and say, this one's particularly bad. Mm. Individual scientists do that. Not like they don't have like some secret meeting where they all get together and make this decision. Individual scientists make these decisions all the time, and then sometimes there's a subset of the community that gets very agitated about a particular kind of doctrine. And so they clearly know what they have a sense of why they're so upset about this thing. But I don't think we're going to be able to come up with a sort of checklist where if you have four of these five properties, you're pseudoscientific, and if you have two of five, you're not. The reason I don't think that is in part because of the point I said earlier. Everybody thinks they're a scientist. So Velikovsky thought he was being a scientist. As a result, he did things the way the scientific community did them. So if you just have a formal list of criteria, must wear black tie, must have nice shoes, must do this, then he'll do all those things because those are the rules of the game. It's just he's not doing them quite right. And anytime you specify an additional criterion, various members of the creation science community or the UFO abduction community or the ESP community will meet those criteria.
And so, I mean, but there, you know, the scientific community is going to say, well, look, there are certain sort of similarities that all these, it seems like that all these sort of pseudoscientific things have in common, right? I mean, they're going to try to sort of point to things like falsifiability, like you know, for instance, you know, one thing that comes up that I hear a lot is confirmation bias. That it seems that these are individuals who, confirmation bias is basically looking at the stuff that sort of supports your theory and ignoring the things that don't support your theory. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And I mean, if we go back to, you know, I really like this case, this Velikovsky case. I mean, is he guilty of confirmation bias? I mean,
there's no question he's guilty of confirmation bias in that he looks through the myths trying to pick out things that specifically look like they're his thing. On the other hand, scientists are guilty of confirmation bias all the time. Like, if you look, a good example is continental drift, which when it's proposed in the 1920s, is rejected by most geologists. And they look at their evidence and say, yeah, that's not right. Can't be right because of this and this and this. And Alfred Wegener, the guy who proposed it, is guilty of confirmation bias. He's just picking out the other data that look like they fit and ignoring all this other data. About 40 years later, all the geologists are in favor of continental drift, or what is now called plate tectonics.
Right.
And the reason why is so confirmation bias is something that all of us are guilty of, and you have to try to overcome it. But you can't just say this person's only looking at the evidence that supports his theory and not the other ones, because Velikovsky could say the same thing about the scientific community. He's like, why aren't you at least doing the tests I ask? Why aren't you guys are ruling out this mythological evidence as worth anything. Even though these people were alive in the past, if they had seen if this thing had happened, they probably recorded it. So why don't you look at the evidence? And they said, no, right. We don't want to. So confirmation bias is an important psychological fallacy that we do, but I don't know if it picks out just people on the wrong side of this fence.
And obviously, you know, the charge that you can't rule out something just sort of a priori is going to be an important one.
It would be really nice if we could. Would make life much easier for everyone. Science funders would be able to pick out what's good and what's not good. Companies wouldn't have to invest in bad lines of research and development and instead develop only good technologies, but we can't do that in advance, sadly.
Well, it looks like, Michael Gordon, it looks like we have a caller on the line with a question or comment, and I'd like to go to that person. So, caller, what is your first name and question or comment?
Hi there. Thank you for taking the question, and especially thanks for the program. This has been a really great discussion. Michael, I'm Margaret calling, and I have a question. You know, in order to follow everything you're saying, a listener or a reader, if you have all of these explanations available in print, would need a certain level of education just to follow what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like to know is what is, you know, everybody has the right to vote. Everybody has the right to contribute to political action committees, etc. So a lot of people who are climate change deniers have all sorts of levels of education among them represented. And my question is, do you know of data that shows that the less education level on average, the more likely a denial of climate change? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you, Margaret, for the question. It's a great question. There have been studies that have attempted to look at this. It doesn't give, to my knowledge, very clear results. Some particular doctrines, and this is especially true on fringe medical claims, things that some people would call quackery, tend to be much more persuasive to people with a lower level of scientific education. But many of these doctrines, Velikovsky, for example, is a trained medical doctor. Many other people who proposed fringe theories, like the origins of the early ESP researchers, are all highly trained clinical biologists and psychologists. And it doesn't guard you against making false claims being highly trained. Whether there's mass public appeal for something might correlate with that, but in general, scientific theories don't correlate very well with mass public appeal. It's the community of insiders who are considered qualified to judge who make those evaluations. But with respect to climate change, one of the reasons why the climate change denial is an active topic of discussion, well, there's a couple of reasons. One is it's extremely well-funded by various organizations and companies that would prefer not to see fossil fuel regulation. And the second is that there are very highly qualified physical scientists who think that the predictions based on these computer models are not accurate. If it only had the first and didn't have the second, it probably wouldn't have the visibility or hearing that it now gets. As to whether, and that's, I think, why it gets the hearing. It's not the level of popularity with people who are less well-educated. It's rather the amount of credibility it has with people who are very well-educated that makes it, that picks it out as something that agitates the central scientific community very grievously. I hope that addresses the question.
Well, one thing that you know, that I noticed that I thought was sort of interesting, if we go to the vaccine autism connection, that there is some research that the more educated that you are, I don't think the research says sort of what kind of education, but, you know, just sort of college education or high school education, that it's the correlation is actually sort of reversed, that the more more education that you have, the more likely you are to have the belief that vaccines cause autism.
Right. I think specifically that among the people who believe that vaccines cause autism, there is a higher than average proportion of college-educated people as than you would expect from the population as a whole.
Uh-huh.
And part of the reason for that is scientific information comes in many forms and is much more widely accessible than it used to be when it was only in science libraries. And people can read through them and try and puzzle through what the study is saying. And the way scientific language is written is in terms of error bars and uncertainties, and this is likely the case because of this. But it's very rarely definitive. And it's very rarely definitive because the quality of our evidence is the quality of our evidence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But somebody who is very well educated and can parse this stuff could think that they are qualified to come to an alternative conclusion from the evidence presented to them. So it's not a slam dunk one way or the other where all the experts, if only the expert, we should only listen to the experts and not to other people, because the question is, what experts would there be? And it's also the case that sometimes interesting ideas come from people outside of a specific community who then inject new interesting ideas in that help make science progress. Mm-hmm. But the phenomenon of accessibility to information and interpreting what the scientific community thinks are legitimate, very strong claims, vaccines do not cause autism. When you read the articles that refute the claim, they say extremely unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
But they won't say absolutely. And it's in that little margin that there's room for doubt. And if you're worried about the potential for that, you might find room to expand.
But, I mean that seems... all of science, you know, that they never make the claim that anything is sort of absolutely certain, right? I mean,
short of a theoretical physics mathematical demonstration, no. So this potential is everywhere,
right? So I guess, you know, we can say that people get it in their head that something is possible, and from that, maybe put a little bit too much into that. Is that?
They think it's possible, and then they look around for other information. This is the confirmation bias problem coming in again.
Okay.
They look around for other information that might confirm that point of view, and they probably find it because they'll find something else that's uncertain, or they'll find a paper that makes the claim very strongly that they agree with, and don't look for the refutation of it that comes later.
Right.
But in the case of the autism vaccine dispute, the original paper that was cited,
the Lancet,
the Wakefield paper that argued that there was a link between autism and vaccines, published by Wakefield in the Lancet, which is Britain's leading medical journal, was retracted as not credible. And explicitly repudiated, and yet people still continue to find that article persuasive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a function of, in some cases, having too much information. I am not someone who's going to advocate for there being less information or less accessibility to the information.
Right.
It's just that when you have information widely available, people will interpret it in lots of different ways, and sometimes they'll interpret it in a manner that the scientific establishment will consider pseudoscientific.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one thing is, you know, just having access and information is one thing, but having the sort of ability or, you know, the requisite sort of training to sort of unpack that information is another, right? I think about, you know, looking at sort of Wikipedia articles about medical science and about things that I have all this information, but I have no idea what, you know, how to evaluate it or to, you know, I don't have the sort of expertise to be able to say whether or not that information is provided me is any good. Is that fair to say?
I think that this is, I mean, the beauty of the Wikipedia idea is that everybody should just put all their information up there, and then eventually the crowd will pick, like, by the people correcting other people's views will converge to the right idea.
Mm.
But it the original encyclopedias, and especially the late 19th century Encyclopedia Britannica, the person who wrote the entries about electricity and magnetism was James Clerk Maxwell, the man who invented the theories of electricity and magnetism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they asked the local expert to write the entry in as accessible a way as possible in order to make it available, reliable information available quickly. Wikipedia allows much more information to be available and has a mechanism for checking reliability, but it's on average corrects for that. It doesn't do it forever. Immediately or for every single thing. And so as a result, it's very hard to evaluate that information. You have to make a decision of who the expert is you're going to trust. Say there's 12 citations for you to follow. Which of those 12 is reliable and which one isn't requires you to, again, make a demarcation judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the way down, like turtles.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Michael Gordon talk about pseudoscience. He's the Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Princeton, and he's the author of the book The Pseudoscience Wars, Emanuel Velikovsky and the Birth of the Modern Fringe. This is A Public Affair, and I'm your host, Tim Hansel, and we do have a caller on the line with a question or comment, so let's go to that person. Caller, what's your first name and question or comment?
My name is Thomas.
Hi, Thomas.
The first comment is, I think a lot of the pseudoscience comes from religion.
Okay.
That if you don't believe that your God or goddess or whatever you want to call it said that's true, then it isn't true. And the second thing I wanted to say is much of this questioning regarding science is because of the capitalist system. Take drugs, for example. They'll say, well, this drug will do this, and people, of course, use it for other things, but it does it for a while, and all of a sudden it doesn't do it, and then you find out, well, they had what they call these tests and running on people, and they find out that, well, they didn't report it because they can make more money by not doing that. So I think that's the second thing. And the third thing, of course, is political, meaning the point is if you want to get elected and your constituency believes something, you're going to not attack it or not discuss it. You're just going to leave it over and say, well, that's up to somebody else. And I think the fourth thing is the scientists that work for the government often have the correct answer, but the head of the agencies and the political Congress will not allow those to be explained or whatever. And so I'll hang up and thank you for the program.
Well, thanks for those points, Thomas. Yeah, lots of different, pressures that might sort of lead to pseudoscientific belief. What do you think, Michael?
So there's a lot of stuff in there that actually does point to things that we've seen historically. Today, religion is often seen as a thing that, when it abuts with science, causes a distortion, that is, makes it somehow pseudoscientific or not credible. Mm-hmm. And that's partially because today we've defined questions about the nature of God as not being part of science. There are very many religious scientists, such as James Maxwell or Isaac Newton, who did a lot of their work thinking they were making religious points as well as scientific points at the same time. So we could apply a standard now saying things that are religious are out, things that are not religious are in, but then you have a problem with non-religious stuff still, and you exclude things that we would call very good science in the past. Mm. In terms of economic pressures, and much of these, the capitalism, the politics, and the government scientists relate to economic pressure to release certain information or not release other information. There's no question from all the data I've seen that the rise of claims, especially about pharmaceuticals that are considered very fringy, relates to the opening up of direct-to-consumer advertising in the late 90s in the United States, which allowed for a less policed discussion, a more open discussion. That was a decision made in order to, at the behest and lobbying of the pharmaceutical industry, and as well as certain consumer advocates who thought that consumers should get as much information directly without it being filtered through a doctor. But the result of that has been also lots of information getting out there that neither the pharmaceutical industry nor the doctors nor the responsible consumers want to have, and it ends up producing difficulties of making decisions. Mm. In terms of the both the political and the government scientists, that has a lot to do with, well, I mean, the way the scientific community is incredibly heterogeneous. There are lots of people who work for the government, then there are lots of people who work with government grants outside of the government, and there are people who do research in institutions with no linkages at all. And often there's checks and balances from information not being able to get out. The politicization of science, the politically motivated editing of scientific conclusions, I don't even think that's at the level. Pseudoscience is, I think, even the wrong word for that. Mm-hmm. That's manipulation of data. That's fraud.
Right.
Pseudosciences are usually things that are picked out for being sincere, but misguided in some important way by the people who make the designation. Mm. Fraud or hoaxes are almost a different beast.
And I guess we had a comment on our Facebook page, and this might relate to something that you're saying along these lines, but somebody mentioned the Oregon petition that in 1997, 31,000 individuals signed this petition against further study of climate change or against, basing policy based on climate change. And apparently, 9,000 of those individuals had PhDs. And the question is, would we call that pseudoscience, or is that maybe this other thing that you're
I would like to think that PhDs protect against various claims. They don't. There are many instances of people with doctorates believing dumb things. There are also many instances of Nobel laureates in sciences believing things that are widely considered by the rest of the community pseudoscientific.
Mm-hmm.
Two quick examples, one of which is clearly political and the other of which is much less so, but still politically obnoxious. The first is two physics Nobel laureates, Philipp Lenard and Johannes Stark, who were experimental physicists in Germany who had very detailed work that proved the basis for the photoelectric effect and for various quantum quantum atomic behavior.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1930s, become strong advocates for a Nazi ideology-friendly version of physics that would that declared pseudoscientific everything that Einstein and quantum mechanics said. This Aryan physics movement, as it was called, it's a very small movement, but it had two Nobel laureates in physics advocating for it.
Hmm.
Widely considered pseudoscientific by everybody else in the scientific community, but the fact that they had this credibility made their arguments more visible than it would have been otherwise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other is William Shockley, who won the Nobel Prize for developing the transistor, who later in life develops an idea for a sperm bank of super geniuses in order to breed a new, better person.
Okay.
it's a fascinating moment. It's a weird 60s moment. It correlates with various views opposed to the civil rights movement. And that... he's widely attacked for having those particular
mm-hmm.
views as a revival of eugenics, a supposedly discredited pseudoscience, or a discredited supposed pseudoscience. So these views are very prominent despite the fact that some people with all the credentials advocate for them.
Right.
I don't want to say that that's a way of discounting someone who has credentials. Much of the criticism of the climate change models made by these credentialed university faculty, physicists, etc., have helped improve the models by forcing people to make more rigorous arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these attacks can occasionally spur greater innovation, greater rigor.
Mm. And more evidence, right?
More evidence and better method.
Right. Well, we have another person on the line, Michael, and I want to get to that individual.
Sure.
So, caller, what is your question? Your first name and question or comment?
This is John. I think an earlier explanation kind of explains, at least for me, what's going on here. I don't think the average person realizes that science at every level, from hypothesis to theory to law, carries a probability. And it doesn't matter what the mathematics shows. If events indicate something different, you may need a different mathematics. You may need different variables. At every level, there is a degree of probability. It decreases, obviously, the farther you get out to laws. There's very little doubt, but there still is some doubt. In other words, mm-hmm. everybody believed Newton, but Einstein proved at certain speeds. You better take other things into account. People can't accept that. They want some certainty. There's a lot of things that science can't deal with. It's like Popper said, the expert can tell you the best way to get from X to Y, but he can't tell you whether you want to go from X to Y. You know, there's a lot of teleologic things. I don't think they're ever going to be able to prove or disprove the existence of gods, for example. Or why haven't we been visited by space aliens? Did all these civilizations blow themselves up atomically? Or did a new silicon-based life exterminate the carbon-based life? I don't know, but... people have an urge for certainty and all-inclusive explanations, leaving aside all the commercial reasons to doubt various things like climate change and the fact that there's corrupt science and there's bad pharmaceutical companies that won't pay attention to evidence and all the rest of it. I think there's a fundamental problem with human beings accepting the probability nature of science.
Thank you very much, John. I think that's actually absolutely right about there's an expectation, because we value science in our society very much, that that it is our best approach to what the world is like reliably. There's a tendency to think that therefore it's certain in what it says, and that it will only say one thing, and that one thing will never change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, in fact, how science is, and sometimes there's reclassifications of Pluto not being a planet, and people get upset about that because they learned it one way, and science is supposed to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
But many things we now think about dinosaurs are the opposite of what I was taught about dinosaurs when I was younger, and that's because science changes, always with probabilities associated with how likely it is that this claim is true. Mm. And with a proper apprehension of that, there would be much less of these kinds of discussions. Unfortunately, that's not something that's likely to change because that's not how we're brought up to think about science, and that's not how most scientists think about their own work or the status of their discipline in the world.
Mm. But isn't that what, you know, when we turn to what gets called sort of pseudoscience, I mean, isn't that sort of the problem, is that they don't, you know, one of the things that kind of picks out pseudoscience is that the theories don't change, right? That they sort of stay the way that they are. I mean, the astrology, you know, a classic example of what people might call sort of pseudoscience hasn't really changed since its inception.
Well, even if you have to go way back to see change, mm-hmm. when it was almost indistinguishable from astronomy, there was lots of different models. But even that, the creationism, the flood geology hypothesis that Noah's flood caused the shape of the surface of the Earth now, mm-hmm. was first promulgated in the interwar period and went through actually substantial changes.
Is that right?
Different people arguing for richer, more complicated models of hydraulic flow. The expert on this is local Madison professor Ron Numbers, who wrote a wonderful book, The Creationists, about precisely how the doctrines do change. ESP has rather significant modifications over time as people try to come up with better and more precise examples.
Hmm.
If it were the case that the theories were just static, those people wouldn't be able to think of themselves as scientists, and I assure you they really all do. People did critique Velikovsky, saying that his picture wasn't changing. And he resisted that idea, but several of his followers tried to introduce changes in the model in order to show that it was adapting to different evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's there are some cases where that works, and there are other cases where it doesn't. I just don't think the blanket rule is going to be possible to be found.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left here, Michael, and I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation. But I thought we'd sort of end, you know, back to the demarcation problem. You know, one thing that I was thinking about when I started thinking about, you know, what is pseudoscience, is I remembered sort of Wittgenstein's sort of famous definition of a game, that he said that, you know, there's no way to sort of, you know, really give adequate sort of necessary and sufficient conditions for what counts as a game. But he posited this idea of there being sort of a family of resemblances.
Yeah.
What do you think about that in relation to this idea of the demarcation problem?
It's a great point. It's the thing that's probably closest to finding something that will demarcate off, is you can say this has family resemblances to these other doctrines. For example, the people who thought the ozone hole wasn't expanding and climate change isn't happening and that acid rain isn't bad, those have very strong family resemblances in how they argue. They're mm-hmm. funded by the same people. They come out of the same think tanks, and they have the same people behind them, like arguing the points.
Mm-hmm.
There's a set of family resemblances there that's very strong, but it won't work across everything. Like, all the various strands of parapsychology have various things in common with each other. And you could say, well, that demarcates them off. But at the edges, they also have a lot in common with perceptual psychology, mm-hmm. which we think is not a pseudoscience. So they have family resemblances to other fringe doctrines, but they also all have family resemblances to non-fringe doctrines. So it's a helpful guide to start looking in certain areas and grouping things together, but it won't group all the pseudosciences together, and it won't necessarily cut the world between the pseudo and the actual
right.
cleanly. Again, regrettably. It would be great if we could.
All right, Michael. Well, we're at the end of our hour, and you know, we have to go, but thank you so much for joining us, Michael
thank
Gordon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. The author, Michael Gordon, the book is Pseudoscience Wars,